Hi.
Hello.
Welcome back to Old Millennials, a deep dive on shallow topics from the late 90s and early 2000s. I am one of your hosts, Emily Bejean.
And I am your other host, Margot Poupard.
Sometimes we have actors out there who somehow have a string of films in which they end up somehow playing romantic leads over and over again. Some of them, it's like quite obvious that they're primed to be romantic male leads. And then there are others out there, like Adam Sandler, that somehow have carved their way into a romantic leading man type of role in Hollywood.
I gotta stand up for my sand man here because I gotta say he's not even the worst one of the bunch. I must tell you that it was Josh Hartnett, but there was a time, or at least from my end, it was Josh Hartnett. But there was a time where just like girl groups, it was like a producer or a studio head or somebody who has the power to make movies get made would just pick a random white guy and be like, you? I mean, there's literally no other explanation. Just like, I think, yeah, maybe you could pull it off. We'll just try it. We'll just see. I mean, the power of being like a attractive white guy is strong. So That's honestly 90% of the battle, because worst comes to worst, you're like in, I don't know, Ghosts of Ex-Girlfriends Past. I mean, Matthew McConaughey is a very successful rom-com career, but you know what I mean. Like movies that are like that, where they're like, yeah, we'll try, Jesse Eisenberg as like a romantic comedy lead. And who cares if we lose 30 million? Like maybe it'll be a hit in Across the Pond or something, which sometimes they are, which is why you get like Sarah Michelle Gellar's Simply Irresistible. I saw it in France and then it didn't ever get released to the States till like way later. So yeah, you can bomb in other countries. Who knows? But yeah, they just try stuff. And if it fails, it fails.
I also found it's funny you should say Across the Pond, because I think that the 90s certainly helped propel some of the British leading men that we'll talk about with, like, we talked about Cool Britannia before in our podcast, where like everything British was really big in the mid to late 90s, thanks to like Princess Diana and Tony Blair and the Spice Girls and Oasis. And like, I think the same goes for like British rom-coms just had like a huge 10-year period from like 95 to about 2005, thanks to Richard Curtis and etc. Like, there's just this period where these guys are great actors, but also just happen to be right place at the right time, I think, for some of these, in addition to like studio heads being like, we'll make you a star.
Well, I think people have talked about this a lot recently, and then the conversation restarted again because I don't know if you watched the Parent Trap 3 Zoom thing. I did not, but it's something like that, that sort of like makes you think about in the 90s and early 2000s, there was just sort of like a plethora of like mid-budget rom-coms just around, you know, just people making things like, I mean, I wouldn't say that their budgets are like necessarily small by any stretch of the imagination, but you would have like top tier comedic talent in these rom-coms that were just sort of like crowd pleasers that would end up kind of being syndicated on cable. So you could count on them kind of seasonally, depending on what the topic is. Yes. So, you know, things totally. Like Four Weddings and a Funeral, or even like You've Got Mail get kind of lumped into like a fall or even like Christmas. I mean, I love watching You've Got Mail at Christmas.
Oh,
I think
of course.
Perfect Christmas movie.
It's a fall Christmas movie for me. And it's funny you bring up You've Got Mail, because I just listened to the Blank Check episode. They're doing a series. They did a series on Nora Ephron, and they talked specifically about You've Got Mail and how it is exactly how you classified it. We don't make kind of these mid-level rom-coms as much anymore. They're either going to be super duper big budget, or they're like of the indie variety, or a streaming service is producing it. But
exactly.
There isn't this mid-level, oh, we're going to make this movie. It's going to have these big stars who have just gotten nominated for an Oscar, or just are, you know, off the heels of like their biggest hit film ever. Mm-hmm. And it's going to do moderately well, but more than anything, it's going to pay back for itself in the syndication and re-airing of it over and over again on TBS.
And maybe that's why these sort of mid-tier rom-coms get more easily made on like a Netflix or a Hulu or something like that, because they can just keep making money. They basically pay themselves back, essentially, and directly too, just through like membership subscriptions, and I'm sure a bunch of other numbers that I am not qualified to speak on. But it's sort of like, yeah, it's sort of like an ABC Family movie or whatever. Like, you made the movie, you financed it, and then you reap all the benefits, and especially in syndication or getting it licensed other places. And with the built-in licensing fees of like having like a Hulu or a Netflix or an Amazon, you kind of you just like make back just straight up money. So yeah, it makes sense. And I mean, I watched recently Rachel Lee Cook and the Wayne's son from
Damon Wayans Jr.
Thank you. That was actually really, really cute. And I thought it was really well shot in terms of like some Netflix rom-coms can kind of be hit or miss in terms of like camera lighting quality. Like sometimes they kind of like make it go a little too Lifetime area or like a little too, I don't know, but this was like really well shot and it was very, very charming and it went down real smooth, like a very easy watch. Like before I knew it was already over, I was like, oh, that was really fun. What a good time. And they were both just, they have like a lot of chemistry and it was actually, there were a few laugh out loud moments and it plays directly into the tropes. But sometimes with Netflix movies, you can tell where the budget is because crowd scenes, like this isn't 13 going on 30 where you can get like that kind of crowd for that dancing. There are literally like three, you know, ancillary characters and like the six same Canadian extras in the background. Like, and so you can kind of see it at the edges, but you know, if you just stay focused on the main couple, you'll have a good time.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. I was also going to bring up, I think another great example of the, here's a streaming platform who did this right was Hulu with the, I think it's called Plus One. It's with Meg Ryan and Dennis Quaid's son and Maya Erskine, who's on Pen 15. And they were great together, too. That was one that was like goes down very smoothly. Lots of fun to watch. Really well done. Just all around believability. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. And I can't wait to watch this Rachel Lee Cook, Damon Wayans Jr. movie.
But if you had to pick, like, if you had to pick somebody right now who you would call a romantic comedy lead, who would you even say? Like, I would say Seth Rogen, just because the last rom-com that I truly loved was Long Shot. And I obviously loved him in Knocked Up as well, even though, you know, like the man baby archetype is a little bit played out now. But at the time, it was like, he's very charming. He's so funny. And even though he's like a stoner, he still makes it sort of like, I don't know, just like a lovable oaf kind of thing, which I kind of talk about later on with Adam Sandler. But I mean, Matthew McConaughey doesn't really do romantic comedies anymore. So
who else is there? I feel like of our generation, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head with Seth Rogen. I would say a couple years ago, I think they were trying to make Miles Teller into a bit of this like goofy rom-com lead or like buddy rom-com
lead. Oh, no, thank you, ma'am. I watched that One Night Stand movie or whatever. I was like, this is fucking painful.
Oh, with Anna Lee Tipton from America's Next Top Model.
To tie it back into the OM universe. Yes, correct. Yeah, I couldn't even finish it. It was, I don't buy him as like a rom-com lead. It's like the last, they were trying to pitch Ashton Kutcher and Justin Timberlake, which, you know, we mentioned this before, No Strings Attached and Just Friends with Benefits or whatever. I almost said Just Friends, which is a different rom-com. But that didn't really take either. So I don't really know. Yeah, it's like we've got Seth Rogen and then maybe Damon Wayans Jr. I think that he was really good in that Netflix rom-com.
Yeah, and I liked him in everything, like Happy Endings, he was fantastic in, and New Girl, the bits and pieces that he was in as coach was good as well. So I think there's a lot of potential. I hope to see Damon Wayans Jr. in more rom-coms. But yeah, I feel like in terms of our generation,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but Henry Golding, he is also a great, very recent addition between Crazy Rich Asians. And did you watch Last Christmas?
No, because I don't want to bawl my eyes out, but I probably will in like a month.
I mean, go ahead and watch it. I don't know if you're going to cry. It's okay. It's all right.
Yeah.
I don't know. They covered it on Flophouse, so that should really kind of tell you everything. I don't think you're going to cry. But he, I mean, it really kind of, to me, solidified him as a romantic comedy lead because he is gorgeous, but he's also very funny. So you have this feeling of like, oh, is this like Ugly Duckling syndrome? No. Although I'm sure he's just been hot his whole life and he's just a nice person. But he's really, I mean, between Crazy Rich Asians and that, I'm like, I love you, I think.
And he was also very good in A Simple Favor where he plays Blake Lively's husband.
Oh my God, yes. He was great in that. That movie was very odd.
Which I enjoyed it as well because I like Paul Feig though. I think he does a good job writing for women much better than so many other male comedy writers.
Like we keep saying, you know, went down smooth. Like you watched and you're like, what the fuck am I watching? You're like, I can't stop watching it.
Exactly.
You like all of the players, but you don't quite understand the game, but it's not enough for you to turn it off.
Exactly.
But anyway, but we're not going to talk about rom-com leading men of now. We're going to talk about rom-com leading men of yore, of the golden age of the 90s and early 2000s.
Yes. And on that note, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Sure. I mean, I can start. I mean, so I think it'd be helpful to break down that we each decided, well, through various text messaging, we came to the conclusion that in this time frame, there were three categories of rom-com leading men. And it was like a British guy, a teenage brooding heartthrob, and the funny, lovable idiot type. And so for my Brit, I picked Hugh Grant. And until this episode, the only thing I knew about Hugh Grant outside of his acting career is that he was arrested for soliciting a sex worker around the corner from my dad's first post-divorce house. After that, my mom was less cool about me going over there, but he eventually moved, so it's fine. Anyhoodle, so a little bit of background about Hugh Grant, because I didn't know this, and it kind of makes sense because obviously, you know, rom-com leading men don't just drop from the sky. He garnered attention after some mild success of a student short that he made in college. He was offered a small role in 1984's The Bounty, starring Anthony Hopkins, Grosso, Mel Gibson, and Laurence Olivier, but was unable to join the cast because he wasn't the British version of SAG, which is Equity, which I think is also like it's a theater thing too, but I don't, whatever.
Excuse me, Margot, the theater.
The theater, pardon me. Grant toiled in theater and BBC sounding shows, even started a sketch comedy group called The Jockeys of Norfolk.
Of course fucking, he did.
A fucking Shakespeare joke. I was like, get the hell out of here, dude. But at 32, he was allegedly on the brink of giving up acting when a little-known motion picture called Four Weddings and a Funeral came around and ultimately made him an international star. This will be the first of five rom-coms he'll go on to star in, written by Richard Curtis. And apologies to Mindy Kaling's Four Weddings, but there is no beating this absolute fucking classic. Okay. So after four weddings and a funeral, he takes a three-year hiatus and he returns in 1999, opposite of Julia Roberts, in another Richard Curtis motion picture, Notting Hill. Notting Hill was a smash hit, beating records previously set by his most famous movie to date at that time, Four Weddings and a Funeral. It made $363 million worldwide, sealing his fate as a rom-com man for many years to come. Now, more relevant to our purposes for this episode, The Rise of Hugh Grant, Bridget Jones's Diary, About a Boy, and 2 Weeks' Notice. So in 2001, he took on the role of Daniel Cleaver in Bridget Jones's Diary, which will be the third of five movies in his Curtis Assance. Adapted. That's what I decided to kind of call it. You can tell me if it sticks or we can kind of like workshop it later, but that's what I have for now. Adapted from the Helen Fielding novel, he plays a horny book publisher who fucks with Bridget, although critics praise his performance for going quote-unquote against type because he was known for being posh and nice, which like, I guess, also kind of like a lovable loser if you're going by the Four Weddings character. Anyway, and he also showed off more of his comedic chops in this role. It was another box office hit, and it further cemented that not only can he open a movie, and it's not a fluke, but he doesn't need Julia Roberts to have star power. Bridget Jones's Diary made $281 million worldwide, and in 2002, he received his best reviews as Will Freeman in About a Boy. Another adaptation, this time from Nick Hornby, who has a new book out that I need to order. About a Boy was universally praised and the script was nominated for an Academy Award. For his performance, Roger Ebert called Hugh Grant the new Cary Grant. Although it was released the same weekend as Star Wars Episode II and it didn't perform as well as his last three hits, I'm sure three Golden Globe nominations and a London Critics Circle nomination didn't hurt. Later in 2002, he starred alongside Sandra Bullock in another banger, at least I think, 2 Weeks' Notice. It was written and directed by the writer of Miss Congeniality, who will team up with Grant again later for music and lyrics, which is extremely charming as well, Mark Lawrence. 2 Weeks' Notice wasn't well received by critics and was about as financially successful as About a Boy, so like kind of middling. Critics are dumb. This movie is very charming. Sandra Bullock plays like a high-powered lawyer for Hugh Grant. Hugh Grant is like a rich man baby who's never had to work a hard day in his life. She gives her 2 weeks' notice, and then they fall in love over the course of those 2 weeks. And I don't know. I really enjoy that movie, especially the scene where
I do too. Always. That was a great DVD. You know what? That was a DVD that I had, and I remember watching that movie a lot.
I think it's kind of, to me, is kind of like a feel-good movie. And also, for some reason, Maybe it's like the tone and it's a little bit of the setting as well. It kind of like invokes a little bit of While You Were Sleeping, which is like one of my favorite rom-coms. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoyed it. There's like that Ty scene in his closet where she quits, which is like, I don't know. I thought it was very funny. I haven't seen it in a while, but I think I would still like it. And then there's like a really good reoccurring bit with like the Chinese restaurant and Sandra Bullock, and her parents are Penny Marshall and some other like character actor that's escaping now.
It's Dana Ivey is her mom.
And then
her father is not Richard Kind, but someone like Richard Kind.
Yes. I didn't write any of it down because I wasn't expecting to go down this like 2 weeks notice rabbit hole just off the cuff, but I really like it. I think it still holds up. And I also consider it a holiday movie because part of it does take place over Christmas. Okay, moving on. Peak of the rom-coms, Love Actually. Okay, hot take o'clock. I can't stand this movie. I think it is so overplayed in every sense of the word. But I cannot pretend that I don't not own this movie on DVD. But I can also tell you that I don't really have a way to play it, even if I wanted to watch it, which I don't. I still stan Sir Richard Curtis. And I don't know, just the internet has like a way of ruining things. Anyway, enough about me. Hugh Grant in 2003 played the British Prime Minister in the ultimate romantic comedy, you guessed it, Love Actually. The directorial debut of his most frequent collaborator, Richard Curtis, it was a box office hit that he is accustomed to having, especially when he collaborates with him, grossing over $246 million worldwide. As the Prime Minister, Grant was at the height of his rom-com leading man powers, or as Roger Ebert puts it more eloquently, quote, Grant has flowered into an absolutely splendid romantic comedian. But all things that go up must come down. And after Love Actually, he took a 2-year break and then came back with American Dreams, which I've talked about on a Medium post about our three blonde pop stars because it co-stars Mandy Moore. In recent years, he has told everybody that he has aged out of rom-com leading man status, with the exception of 2018's The Rewrite, which is written by Mark Lawrence, the same writer behind 2 Weeks Notice. He's mostly stayed away. He was in Paddington 2, a Guy Ritchie movie, and now he's in a David E. Kelly miniseries for HBO with Nicole Kidman. And you've got to admire his absolute dedication to character, as he only got married 2 years ago at the age of 58.
I see that for Hugh Grant.
Doesn't
like
it make total sense? Yeah.
It makes perfect sense. Perfect
on brand. Sense. Very yes. on brand.
Very on brand. Well, my Brit that I chose has played either opposite Hugh Grant or has been in the same movies as Hugh Grant, or just like Hugh Grant adjacent, does a lot of Richard Curtis films as well.
We have a lot of crossover with these two, just a lot of crossing streams.
Yes, yes. And my British actor, if you didn't guess already, is Colin Firth. Like any good English major, I've been obsessed with Colin Firth since watching him play Mr. Darcy in a BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice in high school lit class. I also love that he played a modernized version of Mr. Darcy in Bridget Jones's Diary.
He was Shwing, two words. Shwing.
Shwing. He was first discovered when he was playing Hamlet in the Drama Center London End Year production, where he studied the theater. And then he'll go on to get first cast in a West End production of a play called Another Country. And later will be in the movie version playing a different character opposite Rupert Everett. And by the way, this begins a feud that lasts for 20 years on and off between Rupert Everett and Colin Firth, which I did not know was a thing until I researched this whole thing.
Because they're British, it's such a polite feud that you don't even know it's happening.
Polite.
And it's probably just like deeply shady. It's just little jabs here and there over the course of 20 years that amount to a feud.
Oh, yes. I pulled some quotes just to emphasize
Oh, perfect.
This.
Thank you so much. Okay, great. Let's go.
So Rupert Everett calls Firth, quote, boring, and said he was, quote, a ghastly guitar-playing red brick socialist who is going to give his first $500,000 away to charity.
Oh, my God. First of all, rude, but also very funny.
Very funny.
I mean, he is kind of boring. Like, you look at him, you're like, yeah, you're boring, but there's something about you. There's something about, like, a boring himbo that you just swing. That's all I got.
And then Colin Firth responded later in some interviews that, quote, we didn't get along very well the first time we worked together.
I think
he was probably terribly threatened because I was an awful lot better than him.
Okay.
They They will star together in The Importance of Being Earnest, which we'll talk about a little bit later. In 1987, he gets called a part of the Brit Pack, which I guess was a British journalist's response to the Brat Pack. Basically, a bunch of young, mostly male, white British actors who had been in a couple of plays together and were starring in a bunch of dramas together. This also includes Tim Roth in this list, as well as Bruce Payne and Paul McGann. And Daniel Day-Lewis and Gary Oldman will also be considered part of this list, as well as Rupert Everett, kind of adjacently. But none of these people actually really hung out in real life, so it was nothing like the actual Brat Pack, so it felt very forced. Later on, he'll be in a slew of other movies in either kind of bit parts or he leads, but it's not a, you know, great big movie. For instance, Miloš Forman directed a movie called Valmont, which was based on Dangerous Liaisons, or Les Liaisons Dangereux. That came out a year after the 80s movie with Michelle Pfeiffer and John Malkovich, but was not at all as successful. Which, by the way, the casting in this version is wild. Like, Fairuza Balk plays Cecile. And then in an interesting twist, Colin Firth goes on to have a relationship in real life and father a child with Meg Tilly, who played his co-star, much like how Ryan Phillippe and Reese Witherspoon got together. But I digress. There are a couple of other things that come up, but what really puts Colin Firth on the map is, of course, Pride and Prejudice, where he goes on and plays Mr. Darcy. He was really afraid of being typecast after this role, and he actually even took Bridget Jones a couple of years later so he could make fun of the Darcy character. It's around Pride and Prejudice that he's an English patient, where he plays Kristen Scott Thomas's husband, and then he's in Fever Pitch, like the original Fever Pitch, based on the Nick Hornby memoir. This is the one where it's based on Nick Hornby's memoir, where he's a big fan of Arsenal, and it's this movie that ends up inspiring the American version of this movie starring Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore, which they had to change the name of, because in the UK they already had Fever Pitch. So it's actually called
interesting.
The Perfect Catch is what it's called in the UK. In 98, he'll be in Shakespeare in Love, which we've talked about on the pod before. And then really after this, it's kind of when the floodgates open for the rom-coms and he starts being in all these various rom-coms, including Bridget Jones's Diary, which you just talked about briefly. You know, Renee Zellweger stars as Bridget Jones. It's based on the novel by Helen Fielding. Movie was directed by Sharon Maguire, best known for, before that, directing several documentary series. This was really her first big major motion picture. She's actually one of Helen Fielding's best friends, and one of the characters in the book and movie, Shaza, aka the woman who says fuck all the time with a cigarette in her hand, is actually based on Helen Fielding. As we said earlier, the script adaptation was written by Richard Curtis. We're going to talk a lot more about him throughout this whole spiel. Essentially, this movie ends up making quite a bit of money, making over $280 million worldwide. Colin Firth, from an awards standpoint, won the European Film Awards Audience Award for Best Actor and the European Film Award Jameson People's Choice Award for Best Actor, and then was nominated for a BAFTA for Best Actor in Supporting Role, and then would go on to star in the various Bridget Jones sequels in the future. The next rom-com he appears in is The Importance of Being Earnest. This is where our Everett Firth feud plot thickens. In 2002, the two of them would star together in this film adaptation of Oscar Wilde's Importance of Being Earnest, with Rupert Everett playing the Algernon Algy role and then Colin Firth as the Jack Worthing role slash Earnest. This movie also co-stars Frances O'Connor, Reese Witherspoon, Judy Dench, and Tom Wilkinson. And I forgot that Reese Witherspoon was in this. She's also significantly younger than most of the main cast and her romantic lead. They apparently reconciled Everett and Firth during this movie, but about a year later, Firth was telling journalists that, quote, Rupert and I hate each other. But they've gone on to reconcile. They were in a movie, St. Trinians, together, and then they have stayed friends over that time. Ernest makes about $17 million worldwide on a $15 million budget, so not a huge hit, but kind of, you know, solidifies Colin Firth as a rom-com lead. And this leads in nicely to Love Actually. You already talked a little bit about this, so I'll give my spiel of this. I feel like we could have an episode around the number of problematic things with this movie. Do I still watch it during the holidays? Sure. Do I enjoy a few of the stories? Kinda. Is it weird that Colin Firth and his much younger housekeeper fall in love with one another despite not being able to understand one another?
Absolutely.
Do I normally love Colin Firth but think chunky turtleneck sweaters are not meant to be a thing for him, and that's okay? Yes.
Nodding along with you.
Colin Firth's plot line in this movie, and I'll keep it brief, is that he's a crime mystery writer who discovers his girlfriend slash wife. I don't know. She's banging his brother. He escapes to a French country home where he finds out his new housekeeper is a young Portuguese woman named Aurelia, played by Lucia Moniz, I believe. Despite their language barrier, neither of them knowing a word of each other's languages, they fall in love, which I think the real moment he's turned on is when his papers go all over the place and they're flying everywhere, that all of his manuscript, she jumps into the lake to like rescue this manuscript that's probably shit. And she takes off her clothes, and then we get a big zoom into her tramp stamp, our lower back tattoo, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, my cold British heart has been warmed.
I just say that that's also, I mean, just because they fall in love and they can't speak each other's languages, as proved by 90 Day Fiancé and almost every fucking iteration, language is not a barrier to marrying somebody that you do not know. So I think in hindsight, maybe it's not as bad, other than the fact of what you just described, like her having to get all wet in a pool for him to like fall in love with her or whatever. But the whole not being able to speak each other's languages, this is just like a trailer for 90 Day Fiancé the other way, or whichever one, Happily Ever After, regular, before the 90 Day. We've seen it. I've seen it, at least.
They ultimately realize they're in love with one another. He goes to Portugal to go declare his love for her, proposes. She says yes. They end up together. The end. This movie made a ton of money. I think they did a sequel for Red Nose Day, or a kind of parody sequel for Red Nose Day. Again, I usually kind of hate watch this movie. I enjoy maybe 3 out of the 20 plots that are going on.
So many plots. Denise Richards at the end. I mean, just so much happening.
So much happening. But this segues into What a Girl Wants, which is one of the more interesting choices in Colin Firth's career, because he's down to do a weird movie. Like, he's done 2 Mamma Mia films. But
what's that supposed to mean?
It just means he's willing to have fun. But this was an injury. Yeah.
He doesn't take himself that seriously. Exactly. Sure, yeah. Mamma Mia is unhinged. I totally support you there.
It's a delight and a fucking awesome set of plane movies, like a pair of twin star gems of plane movies.
And I will say, much more fun than the stage production, which I did not enjoy, but do enjoy the films.
Ah, good. I will never waste my money to go see it then. Essentially, we talked about this movie before, stars Amanda Bynes. She's an American who finds out her dad is a British aristocrat. He's played by Colin Firth. She goes to the UK to find him. She finds him. It's all sorts of hijinks. Eventually, they accept one another. The end. This movie ends up making... don't want to go into the plot.
I know, or else we're going to get really into the weeds here. But yeah, it's no, I thought the abridged version is very funny. Yeah, no, they're just like, see past their differences and it's cool. Don't worry.
It's cool. And RIP Kelly Preston. But this movie ends up grossing $50 million, is a great...
And RIP Amanda Bynes' career. Okay, continue.
This movie, another great example of a plane movie. Cannot go wrong. Also a great TBS FX rerun, like that used to play a lot. Excellent.
Or HBO Family, that was on. They've been switching through a couple of Amanda Bynes movies. Like right now it's She's the Man. But a couple of months ago they were playing this movie again, What a Girl Wants.
Yeah, and I feel like Sydney White might make the mix there too.
Ooh, another good one.
Right? I saw that in a movie theater, I think. But after this, Firth doesn't do a ton of rom-coms, apart from the Mamma Mia movies, which let's just talk about the money Mamma Mia movies rake in.
Dude.
Number one, so Mamma Mia won $615 million fucking dollars on a $52 million budget. The 5th highest grossing film of 2008, and that's Dark Knight days, my friend. Dark
Knight. That's insane. Yes. That is insane.
Yes.
Wait, did you say worldwide gross or domestic?
Yes. No.
Okay.
Worldwide.
That makes a little bit more sense, but still fucking out of this world. Okay, well, of course they made a second one.
And then Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, because times are dark and all you need are just people singing ABBA covers. That made $395 million worldwide, which, I mean, like, they're such a delight. They're unhinged. They're wild. The plots make absolutely no sense.
What plot? If you were to ask me what the plot was, I would really have to struggle to tell you. I'd have to look it up. I'd be like, I don't know. And then they're in Greece and then they start singing and then she leaves the dude at the altar. And then in the next one, it's like Cher's there. Like, I don't know how to describe these movies. But I love them.
I love them too. They're a delight. After this, though, Firth really goes down the Oscar bait, prestige drama route.
I mean, we've got King's Speech coming up.
Yep. A Single Man, which is Tom Ford's directorial debut. And then he'll do a couple of fun movies here and there. He'll be in some kids' movies, and he's in the Kingsman movies. But yeah, which are always fun. But honestly, it's that last decade that he's been acting in. It's really been on the more serious front and the prestige drama. I think he's had... obviously won the Oscar for King's Speech, nominated for A Single Man. I think he's been nominated a few times since then. But that's really Colin Firth's turn in the rom-coms. Really, apart from the final Bridget Jones sequel, you don't see him do the rom-com thing very much anymore.
Well, it seems like it's time to move on to teen heartthrobs. Mm-hmm. And initially, I was like, uh-oh, maybe Josh Hartnett is boring? And I almost switched to Freddie Prinze Jr. I almost texted you and was like, there's not a lot here. And looking into it, I can kind of tell why there's not a lot there. But I stuck with Josh Hartnett because maybe a boring heartthrob is what we need during these times.
I have a fun Josh Hartnett connection.
What is it?
So my friend Jimmy is like third cousins with him. I think he explained it to me. He's like, it's his grandmother's second cousin or something like that. But he is related to Josh Hartnett. They're both from Minneapolis.
Well, honestly, that's about as exciting as Josh Hartnett's entire career. So I feel like that's a wonderful way to kick this all off, which is a little section I labeled, did you know? Because I didn't. Hartnett is actually from St. Paul, Minnesota, not San Francisco, as some confused sources once stated at the beginning of his career, which I was like, when was he ever confused for being from San Francisco?
There are truthers out there, and the truth needs to get out. I'm sure there's a QAnon
threat. I was going to say, this is the only QAnon theory I would support, just because it's harmless. After he graduated from a Catholic high school, Emily, he went to SUNY Purchase in New York. It didn't really go well, whatever that means. And by the next year, he had dropped out and moved to LA. He got his big break on a short-lived ABC drama called Cracker. I don't know what it's about. I think it was a crime drama.
About white people?
I mean, I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, he definitely should be on a show called Cracker. I can only guess what it's about. Anyway, even though the show was canceled after 16 episodes, it was critically acclaimed enough that it got him cast opposite Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween H2O. Now he's kind of like getting into a heartthrob in the making. So he does his best Jordan Catalano impression in The Faculty and definitely plants the seed of like, I can pull off being this brooding heartthrob. And then he goes on to play a literal teen dream, Trip Fontaine in Virgin Suicides. But because Trip, even though he drives girls to literally kill themselves, is more of like a plot moving hottie than anything else. And also Virgin Suicides was an indie hit. Therefore, probably not taken as seriously. Hartnett decides to co-lead a rom-drom with Chris Klein and Bobo Ellen Hunt, Lily Sobieski here on Earth, which doesn't really move the needle much at all. The next 2.5 movies where he's positioned as the leading man is best described as a series of small bombs. First, we have Blow Dry, which is about a British competitive hairstyle competition. Think Best in Show, but like not good at all, especially not Hartnett's accent in this movie. He's British for some fucking reason. It co-stars Rachel Lee Cook and RIP Alan Rickman and Love Actually Bill Nighy. He has a role that I couldn't quite figure out how involved his role was. If it was like a co-star or like he was like a D-plot or like just a cameo, but he was in a rom-com called Town and Country, but I don't know what he did, and I forget what it's about, sort of like an outer towners kind of plot line, it sounds like. And it seemed like, from what I could dig up without having to, you know, fork over money to actually watch this fucking thing, which, sorry, I'm not going to do that. And it seems like it was sort of, he's like somebody's fiance or like somebody's boyfriend. And I was like, obviously he's not having like a leading role, but it was, you know, trying to build the momentum to like, he can be like the brooding version of Freddie Prinze Jr., which is maybe why I thought of Freddie Prinze Jr. to replace him. But his best known flop has got to be the seminal Giving Up Jerking It for Lent movie, 40 Days and 40 Nights. a moderate success, but
a
still
lot of
rotten.
Catholic. By the way, there's a lot of Catholic reoccurring themes here. I like.
Well, like I shouted out to you, he also went to a Catholic high school, and I think maybe that's part of it, but I don't really know.
Virgin suicides. I mean, it just keeps going. Yeah.
Virgin suicides, 40 days and 40 nights. It was a moderate box office success, but it has a rotten tomatoes score and not a great audience one either. This movie is best known for that flower scene, which I can't decide if it's like horny or if it's awkward or both. Anyway, it's way too much abdomen. That's for fucking sure. And this concludes his run of rom-com leading man tries, which begs the question, or maybe it doesn't, but I'm going to answer it for you anyway. What happened to Josh Hartnett? The biggest and most obvious difference between Josh Hartnett in The Faculty and Josh Hartnett in 30 Days of Night is that he got older. He was around 20 in 98 and then almost 30 by the time he played a year-round vampire in Alaska or whatever the fuck that movie was about. Simply put, he aged out like a lot of, you know, like Hugh Grant. He bowed out gracefully, I suppose, for lack of a better term. And he aged out of his rom-com role. I would say Colin Firth probably even aged out of like a rom-com leading man role, unless it's like, you know, pardon the term, but like a geriatric, like, oh, something's got to give. Like, oh, these are all just like people in their 60s. And like, this is like a different kind of rom-com. It's marketed different. Like Book Club is marketed different. And if you're somebody that's outside of that demographic, it's almost like you're watching it ironically, even if you do genuinely like everybody involved.
Yes.
I digress though. Simply put, Josh Hartnett aged out of this bracket. But there were a few other crucial missteps in his career as well. According to some of his more recent interviews with The Guardian and Playboy, he says he effectively ended his own career as a leading man when he turned down Superman, Spider-Man, and Batman. Specifically with Chris Nolan, Hartnett goes on to say, quote, I've definitely said no to some of the wrong people. I said no because I was tired and I wanted to spend more time with my friends and family. That's frowned upon in this industry. People don't like being told no. I don't like it. I learned my lesson when Christopher Nolan and I talked about Batman. I decided it wasn't for me. Then he didn't want to put me in The Prestige. They not only hired their Batman for it, they also hired my girlfriend at the time, Scarlett Johansson, which I was like, wait, what? And then I guess I kind of remembered that they'd briefly dated. Anyway, that's when I realized relationships were formed in the fire of that first Batman film, and I should have been a part of the relationship with this guy, Nolan, who I felt was incredibly cool and very talented, but I was so focused on not being pigeonholed and so scared of being considered only one thing as an actor, I should have thought, well, then work harder, but watching Christian Bale go on to do so many other things has been awesome. I mean, he's been able to overcome that. Why couldn't I just see that at the time? And that's... And it's not to say that Josh Hartnett stopped acting. He just stopped kind of being a leading man. Like he was in Lucky Number 11. He was in Smoking Aces. He goes on to have a part in Penny Dreadful, the TV series. But I think that, honestly, I think what really killed his leading man career was also being in Hollywood Homicide, which was not a rom-com, so I didn't include it here, but with Harrison Ford. And that movie was just such a fucking snooze fest and was kind of like ridiculed at the time. And I think that that was kind of like the last nail in the coffin, in addition to him saying no to the wrong people.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's interesting because he had a really strong 5 to 6 year run. And then that
Emily, I would actually even argue that I feel like it sounds greater in our head, but looking at his IMDb, it's like real fucking hit or miss, really. And I think that he kind of skated by truly on his good looks and him kind of being indecisive about what kind of actor he really wanted to be up until it was like kind of too late to really decide. It kind of, the decision got made for him.
It's funny you bring that up because I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt does the complete opposite, where he really defines his career on his own terms.
Yeah.
With Levitt, it's very much like he'll do the rom-com thing, and I'll talk about this when I talk about him, but really he kind of strays away from it and decides that he's really going to focus for a long time during his like peak heartthrob years to be in those like indie dramas that are going to be big at Sundance, big at this film festival, might do moderately well at the box office, but are not going to be, you know, typecasting him as this like hottie, what have you, you know, centerfold in YM, let me cast you in another kind of 20-something dopey comedy.
Right. I mean, he just sort of took the other lead post Third Rock from the Sun, right? He just decided to do, you know, break and go. I feel like he just sort of went the right way and then just kept making the correct choices. And I'm not really sure what that says about the people that are around him versus Josh Hartnett. But that's all I have on Josh Hartnett. He's a nice dude. He's married now and has 2 kids. He lives in London. He's on Penny Dreadful. He's appearing in things here and there. I mean, the nostalgia factor, especially right now, definitely works in his favor. And 40 Days and 40 Nights, I believe, is streaming on Netflix. So I still might go revisit that, because even just watching the trailers, like, this is lit poorly. And there are parts of it that are like kind of a more broad comedy. And then you cut to like these other scenes where he's like strolling around San Francisco, falling in love. And you're like, these are two different movies mashed together. And I remember it not gelling well for a number of reasons. But
does that movie co-star Shannon Sossaman?
You are correct.
That's another person who, like, where is she now? I mean,
well, didn't she come out as like kind of right wingy, and she like lives in Newport Beach or some shit like that?
Yikes. Maybe. I don't know, but maybe. It could very well be the case. But with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, it's been interesting because I think I had it in my head that he was much more of a rom-com lead. And he's kind of gone down that path here and there. But really, he has a couple of major roles that really stand out where he was like rom-com leading man. He kind of decides what he wants to do with his career from a young age, because he was a theater kid. He was kind of, his big first role as a kid was in A River Runs Through It, which is Robert Redford directed, and he plays the younger version of Craig Sheffer's character, aka the brother who's not played by Brad Pitt. Fun fact, Craig Sheffer actually plays the uncle on One Tree Hill, which I forgot about. he's also
gotta
in
bring
Angels
it back.
Gotta bring it back. He's also in Angels in the Outfield with Danny Glover and Tony Danza. He does a couple of other commercials, kid movies, and then gets, you know, his big break when he's cast as Tommy Solomon on 30 Rock from the Sun, which ran from 1996 to 2001. I can't believe the sitcom was on for 5 years. Also, reading the Wikipedia page for this show, apparently Kirsten Johnson and French Stewart are supposed to be playing 20-somethings, which... always think, right?
Okay, that's an interesting number.
It's a choice. That's for sure. Essentially, also because she dates Newman for a while. I mean, his name is Wayne Knight is the actor, but I think of him as Newton forever. I feel like it's a very interesting, I don't know if that show is getting a lot of love, if it's on a streaming service right now. I don't think it's going to be revisited quite the same way many other 90s comedies showing up on Netflix will be. But he essentially continues to play a lot of serious roles when he does get the opportunity to act in film. So he's in a movie called The Juror with Demi Moore. He's also in Halloween H2O, but for like 2 seconds. He's one of the first kills by Michael Myers in that movie. He's like a kid who's like in a house in a neighborhood. And then he's in this is when his indie drama phase starts. He's in a drama in 1998 opposite Samantha Mathis called Sweet Jane. He plays a 15-year-old dying of AIDS who befriends an HIV-positive prostitute that's addicted to heroin. So that's pretty bleak.
So the Walker Texas Ranger clip that they play on Conan, right? Oh, no. Sorry. That's Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah. No. The clip that they – and then on Conan, they also play Mac and Me. Like, so whenever Paul Rudd shows up to promote a movie, he always is like, here's a scene from Ant-Man. And then 3 seconds in, it goes to the same scene from Mac and Me.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Sorry. I was definitely like, wait, is he from Walker Texas? And I was like, whoops, wrong child actor. My bad.
Wrong
sorry
to interrupt the flow. All good. This movie sounds very bleak, but he'll have his first big break. He'll have his first big break as a romantic lead in 1999 when he's cast as Cameron in 10 Things I Hate About You. He did not want to do this movie as he was already making a name for himself, trying to star in these more indie serious films that were not at all tied to his persona as a child star and being on 3rd Rock from the Sun. Even when booking commercials as a kid, his real focus was being a serious actor. In fact, I watched this Vanity Fair series where they have actors go through their roles in the last couple of decades. He said in this Vanity Fair video, quote, "I'll be honest, I was not sold on doing 10 Things I Hate About You when I first read the script. I was like, I don't want to do one of these high school rom-coms. I want to do serious movies." And then his agent basically convinced him because they were adamant that this was going to be one of the better teen rom-coms out there, which, you know, in hindsight, 20 years later, we're still talking about it for that reason. He actually auditioned for the role of Cameron, which he ends up playing, and for David Krumholtz's role, David, which he thought was a really funny role. Ultimately, he's really happy he did this movie, and he actually won a Teen Choice Award for Ultimate Hissy. Ultimate Hissy Fit was apparently a category one. I really hope he has that surfboard award somewhere in his home. But
he probably does not.
He probably does not. That movie, though, doesn't make as much money as we think it should. Like, you'd think with 10 Things I Hate About You was a big hit. It makes about $53 million, which isn't bad considering it wasn't a high-budget film. But ultimately, worldwide, it makes about $53 million. And really, its success is, it's, you know, 20 years later, again, we're still talking about how it's a great movie, barring, you know, one or two exceptions of like, oh, maybe that wouldn't fly in 2020. But apart from that, certainly more solid than several of the other teen rom-coms we've talked about on this show. After this, he is very adamant to not get typecast as another 20-something in teen roles. So he'll go on to just avoid the machine, really, and go into several indie festival circuit films, with the one exception being that he provides the voice of Jim Hawkins in that Disney movie Treasure Planet, which holds the record for being the most expensive traditionally animated movie ever made at $140 million.
I don't even know that movie.
It's one of the ones, I never saw it, but it's like towards the end, Disney stops making like classically hand-drawn animation. There's a bit of CGI in here and there. I just remember that I think the Goo Goo Dolls had to do something to do with the soundtrack.
Oh no, Emily, what a cursed way to start this.
But he'll be in other indie films, including Mysterious Skin and, of course, Brick, which I forgot was Rian Johnson's directorial debut. Shout out to him. We've talked about him on the pod several times before because of the Star Wars movies. This and, of course, his movie out of the newer ones that were released was the best. Also, Knives Out is the gem. And unlike my main man, Colin Firth, Chris Evans does pull off a chunky knit sweater.
I'm sorry, Colin Firth, but it's true. I think we all can see it.
Also, Rian Johnson, I didn't realize, was married to Karina Longworth, who hosts.
Oh, yeah.
Just, I love You Must Remember This. It's a great podcast. Anyway, Brick is a fantastic movie I haven't seen in a really long time. Not going to talk about it too much because it's not a rom-com at all.
In any way, shape, or form.
Nothing romantic about what happens in this high school.
Other than, like, I formed a deeper romantic crush on Joseph Gordon-Levitt, but that doesn't make it a rom-com.
That also, I feel the same way. And sadly, that, what does that mean about us? I don't know.
I don't know.
But the movie actually made $2 million on a $500,000 budget.
Actually, no,
$3.9 million worldwide, $2.07 million in North America. So, you know, for him, he's in these movies that'll make some sort of a profit. But for a while, they're really kind of small indie films. I think the next big one for him is going to be 500 Days of Summer, which I know is towards the end of our, you know, old millennials year range. But I wanted to bring it up because this movie is one of those movies that I kind of still enjoy. I remember liking it a lot more 10 years ago when I saw it, because I think I liked the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character more back then. I think upon rewatching it over and over again, I've now seen how problematic that character is, and how, you know,
I can't bring myself to rewatch it recently because I feel like it's just going to make me cringe.
He's a prototype for a nice guy. Not that bad. Like, and he's not like incel nice guy, but like,
no, but she's definitely like peak manic pixie dream girl. And it's so annoying in retrospect that I don't know if I can overcome it, but I do love the best friend, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's best friend in the movie, who was married to Christina Hendricks.
Jeffrey Arend.
Definitely a saving grace of the movie. The movie, I think, has a lot of style, which is kind of what made everybody really like it more than what was there of substance. But
yes,
I know it's towards the end, but I think that that's what everybody kind of expected him to do more of at this point, and then he just didn't really. With the exception of Don Juan, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, this movie does make pretty good money. It's a sleeper hit. It earns over $60 million for a $7.5 million budget. Obviously gets comparison to Annie Hall and High Fidelity because it's using the non-linear narrative to tell the relationship story. But there's been a lot of interesting analysis of this movie over the years, especially about his character and, for that matter, Zooey Deschanel's character, which she's like peak manic pixie dream girl in this movie. But there's also a little bit of the director taking this is the image that he portrays her in, because this is like how Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character perceives her to be without ever taking the time to see her as more than just these like manic pixie dream girl qualities. I'm not going to go into that too much because we've got lots of stuff to cover. But ultimately, after this, this is when Joseph Gordon-Levitt kind of goes back into the drama, but much on a much more big budget level. So he'll do a lot of Christopher Nolan. He'll be in Inception and then The Dark Knight Rises as Robin. He'll do 50-50, which I really like. It's a dramedy with Seth Rogen. That's a really good movie that I still enjoy. And then he'll do Looper, which is not Christopher Nolan, but always makes me think like Christopher Nolan adjacent a little bit. And then he's also in Lincoln. He directs Don John. And then he'll do a few movies after that, like The Night Before and Snowden. But really at this point, he's kind of focused more on stuff behind the scenes. And then he does like his hit Record Joe stuff. He has kind of an online presence, but he hasn't done that much acting in the last decade. Like movies here and there, or maybe the last 5 years, but like he's kind of been slowing down.
Yeah, no, he's definitely just like a dad. And I think he was recently in like an Amazon show. Like I saw him in a trailer for something on a streaming platform. It might also be like a Netflix movie. I don't remember. But what I remember more vividly than that was around 500 Days of Summer kind of time, or maybe like a year after that. He had an interview in Nylon where he talked about how he likes French girls. And I went peak Jim Carrey, like, oh, so studied. You're saying there's a chance? And he married a French chick. So I was like, God damn it. But
yeah, she's a startup CEO. Like
I think he's just living like the dad life is what it looks like. I mean, I wonder if he'll ever transition into directing, which to me in some ways feels inevitable, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there's nothing left but to tackle the lovable idiots in this category. And I chose him. I chose Adam Sandler. To quote Adam Sandler / Howie in Uncut Gems, this is how I win. So I have a real soft spot for The Sandman, even though I shit on a lot of his lazier, more recent movies. He's more well known for making these lazy movies, these lazy vacation movies with like Chris Rock and Kevin James. But once he was a pretty solid leading man in a rom-com goof, he ran so that Seth Rogen could hit a bong and we could all fall in love with his man-childness. So from SNL to box office rom-com king, it all starts with The Wedding Singer. But before all of that, let's go to 95. When Adam Sandler and Chris Farley are fired from SNL, he basically makes Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, two movies I don't super love and always fucking mix up, pretty much back to back. Both movies did well enough for comedies, but his next movie will turn out to be his most financially successful and critically acclaimed to date. For what would turn out to be The Wedding Singer, Adam Sandler reteamed with his former NYU roommate and writing partner, Tim Hurley, who co-wrote Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. They tapped another NYU buddy to direct, Frank Caracci, who will follow this up with Adam Sandler in The Waterboy. Legend has it, this all happened, though, because it was Drew Barrymore's idea that they team up in hopes of becoming what she has called, quote, a modern, weird Hepburn-Tracy old Hollywood couple.
Wow.
I know. So she had that memoir come out a couple of years ago. I can't remember when, but Wildflower or whatever. And so she has a lot of quotes in there where she kind of owes a lot of her rom-com career to Adam Sandler, even though it was all her idea. Drew Barrymore is the one who called Adam Sandler to meet, hoping that she would be able to convince him that they should star in a movie together. But one look at Adam Sandler when they first walked into their meeting, she realized it was going to take a lot of hard convincing to make it seem like it was going to work. She says, quote, "We look like the worst blind date you've ever seen. I showed up with purple hair and a leopard coat, and he was in his classic cargo pants. I said, I really believe that you and I can get together and do something meaningful, and the rest is history." And thank fucking God that Drew Barrymore entered the picture, because when she got involved, it apparently, quote unquote, inspired Hurley to write the script from a female perspective, which like, oh, gee, thank you so much, rather than just an Adam Sandler vehicle.
And
again,
I think that's why it's one of his better movies. I still love The Wedding Singer. There are some Sandler films I'm not going to revisit, but I enjoy The Wedding Singer to this day.
I will talk about it throughout what I have for The Wedding Singer, but it's one of my favorite all-time rom-coms. I really do love this movie. Again, lucky for them that Drew Barrymore came up with this idea, because The Wedding Singer is an extremely sweet and a very pure 90s rom-com and a personal all-time favorite. On paper, there's a lot about The Wedding Singer that sounds like a shitty Adam Sandler movie with his lowbrow humor. You've got rapping old ladies, you've got broad parodies of the 80s, and his signature yelled the lines. But for whatever reason, as Robbie Hart, it's very endearing and gentle. The Wedding Singer is technically set in 1985, but serves as more of like a broad 80s pastiche than an actual period piece, because I don't think that was what they were going for ever. The Wedding Singer works also because it's grounded and naturalistic. It's a character-based story about a wedding singer who's dumped at the altar and his budding friendship with the woman who's set to marry the wrong guy. The reviews for The Wedding Singer were mixed, and the 1998 film was Adam Sandler's first big box office hit, grossing $80.2 million domestically and $123 million worldwide. That's more than Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore combined. The character of Robbie does a lot of work to, similarly to Hugh Grant, lay the groundwork for Adam Sandler to be considered a lovable dork and a romantic lead for a long time to come. The Wedding Singer frames Robbie as empathetic and compassionate, and treats his knowledge of the wedding industry as a valuable skill and not some like girly cast-off thing. Especially in the way that he's been like dreaming about his wedding day ever since he was a little kid. He's a little bit like Lou Dobler in Say Anything, except all grown up. Mm-hmm. Also, Robbie and Julie's relationship is very easygoing from the start. They have a warm friendship that blossoms into a love very subtly and gradually. And it's not unlike When Harry Met Sally in the sort of like hangout formula, in the sense that like you think you're watching a movie about a girl who's about to marry a shitty dude and a guy who's trying to get over a breakup, and they're helping each other through these things. And then it morphs into, you know, their budding romance. Sort of like this movie kind of like lays a little bit of groundwork as well for like an Apatow archetype as like an immature man child who needs to grow up in order to be worthy of his love interest. But also Robbie's arc is about returning to the person that he was before his breakup, because as you can tell from the beginning of the movie, right before he gets married to Linda, he's so happy and he's in love and he talks about how much he loves weddings. And then after that, it's all doom and gloom and he's trying to find the joy again. But he is a man child that lives in his sister's basement and works weddings, and what is he going to do with his life? You also get Adam Sandler's hilarious performance of a Cure-inspired ballad, Somebody Kill Me Please, which, I mean, I don't know how many times I've sent that gift to friends at work, just like, somebody please fucking kill me. And then when it's coupled with Julia's, I liked it, comment, they have like a perfect chemistry in that moment that kind of only gets strengthened from that point on in the film. But the real threat of the movie isn't Glenn or Linda. It's the sunk cost fallacy that inspires people to marry someone who isn't right for them just because they've been together for so long. Robbie and Julia's love story isn't about destiny or love at first sight. Underneath its 80s set dressing, it's about two people who almost settled for the wrong people before they realized there was someone better out there suited for them. Robbie's Airplane Serenade, Grow Old With You, is a really magical scene, even if they have to share it with Billy Idol. But I think that's exactly why they'll try and kind of mostly fail to recapture the sort of magic with 51st Dates and We're Going to Africa, aka Blended, which, like, please do not get me started on that fucking movie. Romantic comedies often sell this fantasy of having it all, meaning a great partner and a wonderful career, but I love The Wedding Singer because it challenges this conventional bullshit of what having it all looks like. It argues that you don't need to be professionally ambitious to have a fulfilling life, something that we're used to hearing over and over again, and especially as part of like the 80s greed is good ethos. But The Wedding Singer suggests that having it all can mean surrounding yourself with people that you love and doing good deeds for others and finding a job that fulfills you, even if it doesn't pay that much and is vaguely uncool.
Hey, meatballs are a currency and they're delicious.
And that's a really great example of a scene where in like 51st Dates, that would be a completely fucking bungled scene. They would try to make it like really gross or like kind of stupid. But in that moment, Robbie reacts as like an empathetic person who's not trying to put down this old lady who genuinely loves doing what he does, even if he gets paid in meatballs. And I just feel like this movie is so, so pure. It's just such a sweet movie.
It is. It really is.
And definitely had contemplated seriously for my wedding having Grow Old With You play at some point, which I didn't do, but was really, I gave it a good hard think. And personally, this movie holds a special place in my heart as it is the first movie I saw twice because my parents divorced. Adam Sandler's About a Boy, Big Daddy. Sure, yes, Beard, Big Daddy predates About a Boy, but it still, whatever. Kind of similar plots. An eternal bachelor inherits a child that reluctantly makes him a better person. Big Daddy is directed by Dennis Dugan and co-written again by Sandler and Hurley and some man named Steve Franks. And despite its 39% on Rotten Tomatoes, it was a box office success, grossing over $200 million worldwide. It co-stars a variable who's who of comedians, from Joey Lauren Adams and Jon Stewart, a deadbeat dad apparently, the Sprouse twins, and Leslie Mann, who was way too fucking good in this role. This film was Adam Sandler's highest grossing domestic hit until, Hotel Transylvania 2 in 2015.
He's huge international, though. Like, the movies that the last 10 years have bombed. Huge.
I mean, Click, yes. It has like a fucking crazy international box office. I don't talk about it because it's a rom-drom or like a family drama, which he kind of like goes on that bend towards the end of his rom-com leading man career. He pivots into family drama. But yeah, it is crazy. He's huge internationally. He's, I don't know, something about his potty humor doesn't need a language. It's universal. But in case you forgot, Adam Sandler is above all an actor. He did go to NYU, Tisch School of the Arts. So, of course, he had to follow up some of this with Punch Drunk Love. The 2002 movie is technically a romantic comedy, and it's Paul Thomas Anderson's fourth feature and probably the only one in his repertoire to clock in at 90 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That man loves a long shot.
Oh, boy. Does this guy love to tell a story in 2.5 hours or not less? And I say this as a fan. I say this as somebody.
Oh, for sure. Boogie Nights, fantastic movie. But dude, yeah.
I did the obnoxious, like, on the release day of The Master, I went and saw in 60 millimeter, like complete asshole film school shit. Anyway, I love my asshole film school student auteurs. But the script for Punch Drunk Love was finished 3 years before he shot it. But during his press tour for Magnolia, Anderson joked that his next project would star Adam Sandler and clock in at 90 minutes. And that's exactly what he fucking did. Anderson's reasoning for casting Sandler, quote, I love him. And he's always made me laugh. It's Saturday night. And if I want to watch something fun or if I'm sad, I'm popping in an Adam Sandler movie. The last thing I would want to do is watch Magnolia or, you know, Breaking the Waves, which, like, what the fuck? Why are those your two choices? Anyway, so I'm looking to Sandler and I'm thinking, God, I want to get a piece of that. I want to learn from that dude. What is it that's so appealing about him to so many people? I think he's just a great communicator. Just Paul Thomas Anderson being pure about Adam Sandler is very funny to me. Punch Drunk Love was inspired by The Pudding Man, a real person. In 1999, California native David Phillips made national headlines by outsmarting Healthy Choice. He realized the company's pudding was drastically underpriced for the frequent flyer miles mail-in promotion, which it was offering. For $3,140 in pudding, he got himself a whopping 1,253,000 miles and practically unlimited flights. But with the exception of his violent outburst to tie it back to Punch Drunk Love, I do believe Barry Egan shares a lot of commonalities with Robbie Hart. So I do think it is kind of funny that Adam Sandler has gone on to say that he based his performance of Barry off of, quote, his friend Judd as an Apatow. The black comedy romantic drama also starred Emily Watson and P.S. Hoffman. Although it was critically acclaimed, especially Sandler's performance, it was a total bomb at the box office and it didn't even make back its $25 million budget. And then the steam starts to run out, or as I like to call it, 50 First Dates. Originally first titled 50 First Kisses, Drew Barrymore found the script and wrote a letter to Sandler and suggested that this was going to be their next movie together. It was more of a drama, and so Sandler rewrote it to make it more of a comedy. Initially, it was set in Seattle. Sandler later switched it to Hawaii, which that trend will continue. Oh, and he goes on to say, it, quote, just seemed like the best possible place to do it for many different reasons, which is like, that's how you know that someone's about to bullshit you when they say many different reasons. Something about that specific phrase. You don't see many movies set there, which, like, what? Yes, you do. Jurassic Park. Hello. So it was a great experience to film in a different locale. Yes, I too like free vacations to Hawaii. Anyway, this movie was directed by Peter Siegel, who will go on to direct The Longest Yard immediately after this, also with Sandler. It also stars Steve Astin and Dan Aykroyd as Drew Barrymore's brother and father, respectively, and a very offensive Rob Schneider, which I do not want to get into it. If you've seen this movie, you fucking know why he's problematic at best and offensive at worst. The movie was not critically well received, and a lot more gross-out humor was involved than in The Wedding Singer, and it turned off a majority of critics. Most surprising, though, because it didn't do amazing at the box office, it did well enough to inspire several international remakes in Malaysia, in Japan, a couple of Asian countries. I did not write down the names because I could not pronounce them, and I will not do that to myself or you, more importantly. Although it is sweet enough at times, a lot of those moments come at the expense of Drew Barrymore's disability. She has a form of amnesia where she has to wake up every day, and it is literally a brand new day to her. And the movie ends, and I hate to say it, definitely got me teared up, with her listening to the Beach Boys song that is supposed to help trigger her memory start to go that she was, you know, that what day it is. And it comes on with like a video of Adam Sandler explaining their whole life. And God damn it, did I not cry the first time I watched that? So you got me at the very end. She wakes up and she's on a ship and they're in Alaska and it's a dream and it's beautiful. But apparently her amnesia symptoms are actually accurate. There's a woman from 2010 who had a car accident that experienced the same type of amnesia. Then there's also something called Truman Show delusion, which patients believe they're living inside of a reality show, as in the 1998 film The Truman Show, also known as Nurse Betty syndrome. But I digress. After this, you know, he goes into dramatic family roles with Spanglish and The Family Man. I didn't write down all of these other movies, but Click and a couple of others. And in the last couple of years, you know, he's been in Uncut Gems and he's been trying to break away from his lazier movies like The Ridiculous Six or I can't even think of any of the other movies.
All the Grown Ups movies, Jack and Jill.
Oh, yeah. But I'm thinking specifically of his very lucrative Netflix deal that he made a couple of years ago where he's supposed to make six movies. But I heard that Murder Mystery is actually not bad, so I will watch that. But Uncut Gems is really it brought back a lot of, for me, Punch Drunk Love nostalgia because he got so much critical praise and he was very good in it.
I mean, he won the Independent Spirit Award for Best Actor.
And you know what? Unfortunately, the Academy did not want to recognize him. And so as he joked to Howard Stern, we're going to have to watch one more of his like shitty comedies for Netflix. So thanks a lot, Academy.
That was a big snub. And Eddie Murphy for Dolomite last year as well was a big snub. Those were both two people who should have been nominated. That was, Sandler. I mean, it is interesting. Like he has these movies once in a while that come out and you're like, oh yeah, like you, when you want to, you can make these movies. Similarly though, I feel like Ryan Reynolds is one of those people who just kind of got plucked to be a lead. But I appreciate with Ryan Reynolds, kind of to an extent like Adam Sandler, they're both aware of themselves. They don't take themselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of these actors who in any other position would have taken themselves too seriously. But I appreciate that Reynolds over the years is in on it. And I think that's a bit of the Canadian in him. But I digress. Let me talk a little bit about Ryan Reynolds here. His career, it's interesting because he starts acting in the early 90s. It takes him a good like 10 to 15 years before he gets his big break. He'll be on a couple of TV shows here and there. He's in the Sabrina TV movie that we've talked about, which is the predecessor to the TV show. And then he's also on this TGIF show called Two Guys, a Girl in a Pizza Place, which lasts for a few seasons. But really his big break comes in the early 2000s when he is in Van Wilder, which would not be made in 2020. I will put that out there. This is one of those National Lampoon movies, so not quite a rom-com, but there is a romantic storyline here. If you don't remember, Van Wilder is a movie where the guy has been in college for 7 years. Van Wilder, played by Ryan Reynolds, has never graduated and has just kind of resorted to a life where he's planning parties and social events for the campus. And he just kind of parades around in a golf cart all day. His negligent but very wealthy father finds out he's still been bankrolling college for the last 7 years and is like, I'm done paying for you. And so now it's on Ryan Reynolds to like start making money so that he can continue to live this life. In the meantime, there's also Tara Reid, who plays this reporter on the campus who like covers him. They start falling in love, but then there's like a jealous boyfriend who tries to sabotage Van Wilder, but Van Wilder pulls through and he wins and he gets the girl and he graduates and that's it. And then they have one of his best friends is played by Cal Penn, pre-Harold and Kumar, and they've kind of made him offensively into the foreign exchange student type who's his personal assistant. Again, this movie probably wouldn't get made in 2020, certainly not this way. It's actually all based on Bert Kreischer's life. So if you guys know who the stand-up comic is, he's had a lot of Netflix specials. Eileen's seen him in live before. I've seen him live. He's actually very funny. He went to Florida State for 7 years and was so notorious that he got an article in Rolling Stone in the late 90s that was all about him. Because at the time, FSU had just been ranked as like the top party school. And the article ends up being so popular that fucking Oliver Stone, yes, that Oliver Stone, optioned the rights to Kreischer's life to write this story. And he ends up Yes. The development deal falls through. So Oliver Stone did not direct Van Wilder.
What did I miss?
Right. I too thought the same thing as I was reading through all this. But Van Wilder will become fairly successful. It's one of those early 2000s frat movies that makes like almost $40 million worldwide over probably not a really huge budget. After that, he's in Waiting, which, you know, is kind of a minor film, but he's a supporting role there. But I think his first big rom-com really is going to be Just Friends, a.k.a. Ryan Reynolds Wears a Fat Suit. He plays
I know it's bad, just like Shallow Hal, but I do really love Just Friends.
Just Friends is a better film than Shallow Hal. Like, I will yes, not.
Definitely. The Fat Suit only lasts so long.
Right. And I think that ultimately there's some heart in Just Friends, which I appreciate. I mean,
and Chris Klein is like an acoustic guitar playing douchebag is so good. Oh my God. Best part.
Klein plays that role very well. I mean, this is kind of the end of Klein's like career at this point. He'll come back later, especially in that one show I texted you about that I watched on Netflix that has like
Sweet Magnolias. Did you know it got renewed for a season 2? I almost texted you that.
Oh, thank God. I mean, Jamie Lynn Spears and Joanna Garcia Swisher just deserve to continue having a show on Netflix.
Every time you say Jamie Lynn Spears, I am waiting for you to say Jamie Lynn of Sopranos name. What the fuck is her last name?
Siegler.
And every time you say Spears, I'm like, ah, yes, the other one.
But Just Friends will do fairly well. It will go on to make $50 million and has been a great staple on basic cable, I might add. Another prime example that you would see on FX and Comedy Central. But also co-stars Amy Smart, which you've talked about her on the pod before because I think you met her when she was selling something at a store where you worked, if I recall correctly.
Great memory, Emily. Yes, she used to sell her soy-based candles out of a flower store that I worked at in community college, and she was always very nice and super gracious. Not necessarily funny in person or in this movie, but she seemed like she was a very nice person. But you just let Anna Faris and Ryan Reynolds do the heavy lifting, and you're just the lovely romantic lead lady. You know,
exactly. Exactly. And Anna Faris has a good turn in this movie. She's funny. She plays a great comic relief. The next big rom-com that Ryan Reynolds will do is Definitely Maybe, a.k.a. How I Met Your Mother, the movie, a.k.a. Why does this constantly feel like it's the only rom-com available when I look to stream something on Amazon Prime?
Oh my God.
Fun fact, this movie was directed by Adam Brooks, who is best known for writing screenplays for French Kiss, Wimbledon, and Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. Yeah. Very interesting.
Well, you know, I feel like then you started, it was diminishing returns, you know, it was like real strong start and then Wimbledon, I was like, and then Edge of Reason was the last one or the second one.
It's the second one, but I would say the weakest.
It definitely would agree because the baby one, at least, you know, there's like a baby involved. But yeah, I would definitely say like, you know. Started out strong with French Kiss and then, yeah, here we are. Definitely Maybe. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting when Reynolds gets, first off, diminishing returns with scripts, but two, interesting when Reynolds starts to get marketed as a leading man. And in this movie, it kind of works, but it's a little weird because there's a whole How I Met Your Mother vibe to it where his daughter, essentially he's about to divorce his ex-wife. His 10-year-old daughter just had her first sex ed class. She's asking, like, how did you meet my mom? And he goes into the story where he decides to, like, change the names and brings up, like, three different women. So it's kind of like a choose your own mommy adventure for children. And it, like, there's Elizabeth Banks, there's Isla Fisher, there's Rachel Weisz, who, like, I'm very surprised she agreed to act in this. But anyway, I'm not going to dive into the plot here because it's convoluted and very long. And it's like 20 years in the making. But at the end, we find out which one of these was her mother. And then Will, Ryan Reynolds' character, assures her that Maya is the best part of his life. And then there's in the How I Met Your Mother finale twist, it's like, well, wait, why don't you go after the other woman that you're truly in love with? And he's like, all right, 10-year-old daughter, let's go get her. And then he ends up with the Isla Fisher character at the end. They live happily ever after. That movie would go on to make $55 million worldwide on a budget of $7 million.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, surprising, considering I don't remember when this actually came out. I just remember seeing it constantly on streaming services. But more importantly, it's kind of the launching point into his brief foray into more adult rom-coms. So after this, he'll go on to do The Proposal with Sandra Bullock, which is a huge success, grosses over $300 million worldwide, becomes the 20th highest grossing film of 2009. And then, he goes on to do this movie called The Change Up, which is basically Freaky Friday, but with best friends.
Freaky Friday with Jason Bateman. I actually didn't mind that.
No, it's not a bad one. There are far worse movies out there that try to do the same thing. I think Ryan Reynolds did the male rom-com lead a few more times, but ultimately he is best as a funny action star. See Deadpool. I think what I appreciate the most out of Ryan Reynolds, like I said earlier, is his ability to not take himself too seriously. I think it's the Canadian in him. Many of his counterparts with similar careers would be complete D-bags, but I can respect someone who makes fun of his bad role choices. For example, when he did Green Lantern. He references this several times in both Deadpool movies. There's the opening scene, which features a drawing of Green Lantern. Later, a scene where Reynolds' character insists that his suit will not be green or animated. And in the sequel, in the post-credits scene, there's a flashback where Deadpool travels back in time to shoot Reynolds before Ryan Reynolds can decide to make Green Lantern. That's all I really have for Ryan Reynolds. The last decade, I think he has, again, stayed clear of the male rom-com lead, which I think he did to kind of varying levels of success. But I do enjoy him in an action comedy when done right.
With the exception of Hobbs and Shaw, I did not enjoy him in Hobbs and Shaw. I found him to be so grating and annoying.
And that post-credit...
Yes, that post-credit sequence was so unnecessary, but I, of course, have a Ryan Reynolds story too, really, at the peak of around this time, around like Just Friends, like between Just Friends or maybe even slightly before Just Friends, like up until The Proposal, I saw him two or three times, saw him the first time, and actually saw him twice at a Starbucks in Brentwood, and he was always super polite and really nice, and he was always driving around this motorcycle, this Ducati. And then famously, the best time that I saw him was in Larchmont once when Marianne and I were getting sandwiches. He was ahead of us, and we're like, ooh, there's like a really tall, like hot dude, like kind of like striding ahead of us. Like, I wonder who he is. And we're walking up to the door to like get into the sandwich place, and he opens the door, and we look at him. We finally realize it's Ryan Reynolds, and we both gasp. He's like, I know, and then winks at us and smiles. And he was just so nice. And he was like, then he chatted us up in like the sandwich line. I was like, what are you guys going to get? Like, he was just super, like a super fucking nice dude. So even when I feel annoyed with him, I remember he's actually a very nice, gregarious person and seemed very stoked that we recognized him. But this was like Atlantis Morissette time, because I recall having to hold myself back in the sandwich shop being like, how's Atlantis Morissette doing? What is she doing? Where are you guys going? Are you Canadian? Like, just had to really reel it in and be like, I usually get half of a number five or whatever my order is at Larchmont. So
this is, again, the Canadian, like,
he's
a B-list actor, but not all Canadians, right? Like, we have Canadian listeners.
I don't know. I haven't heard a negative story about Jim Carrey, but then again, I don't. Who's asking Dumois on Instagram if they have any good or bad Jim Carrey stories? I don't know, but I have a positive one of Ryan Reynolds.
He sounds lovely. Jim Carrey, again, I've heard good things too. The only thing really problematic about him is that he's an anti-vaxxer to an extent. Like, really.
Association, right?
Guys, you're right. He doesn't have, you're right. It's because he dated Jenny McCarthy at one point. But I will say, like, ultimately,
Emily,
though,
we all make mistakes.
We all make mistakes. And if you are a Wahlberg, you marry that mistake. But I digress. Wow. But I think that is a great point at which we will...
Oh, is it? Is this a good point for us to wrap up? I think so. Before we get beat up by some Wahlberg brothers.
I am. Or an anti-vaxxer in Marin County. Either way, it won't end well. So on that note... Thanks again for listening to us. If you really like what you hear today and you'd like to hear us elsewhere, or you'd like to hear more old millennials, you can check us out on whatever podcast streaming service you use. We're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Spotify, we're on Pocket Casts, we're on Stitcher, we're on Google Podcasts, we're on Amazon Audible Podcasts, you name it, we're there, check us out. And while you're there, if there is an option to rate, review, just tell us if you like what you're hearing, especially on Apple Podcasts, do it. You know, we'd really appreciate any reviews, especially 5-star reviews, and any comments you leave. We've seen a lot of reviews recently. We really appreciate the love. Additionally, we are not just recording, we're also writing. You can check us out on our Medium page. I will be posting something this week on the Baja Men. I know Margo will be posting something eventually on our lesser known girl groups, but we're always posting fun content there. Additionally, we're on social. So if you enjoy a good Instagram account, check us out. We're at the Old Millennials Pod. Same thing with Facebook. We're at the Old Millennials Pod. And then you can also email us. We have an email address. So oldmillennialspod@gmail.com. Check us out. Please email us. And finally, individually, if you want to reach out to us, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Emily A. Bejen.
And I'm at Margs, she wrote.
And until next time, we say bye.
Goodbye.